This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Live your best life
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Great to have you with us on the Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer podcast. This is your chance to catch up on the best bits, listen back to something you might have missed, and learn about experts that you should be connecting with here in the UAE. You might not have heard the name Gift, but she might have delivered you a pizza. We were in conversation with one of the UAE's first female delivery drivers. Gift from Nigeria has scored a job with Freedom Pizza. Speaking to her about that career move, and could we be seeing more women delivering all sorts around Dubai? How do you feel about it? Plus, career mentors. Do you have one? In an age where we might pick up an awful lot of information, insights, and more from those around us, distance learning and indeed distance working might be putting a bit of a spanner in it. In conversation with Andy Phillips, the Chief Operating Officer at the University of Wollongong, about what they're putting in place to help bridge the gap between university and the real world. And as ever, we love to connect job seekers with people who are actually hiring. Please do reach out to us on the show. You can get in touch through the website. If you are looking for a job and you want to share your experiences, plus if you're a company who's hiring, we'd love to act as your radio jobs board. We were speaking to Karishma, who's been looking for a job in sales, plus hearing from a communications agency who is looking for their dream candidate. And I'm unhappy to announce that I've only just paid off my student loan. What about you? It is the result of a survey that shows that, well, so many young people are feeling not only educational stresses, but financial stresses as part of their further education. Speaking to Chegg about that survey to find out more and hearing from you too. Would you actually discourage your child from going to university because of the threat of debt? But what about if your child wants to go into something a bit more unusual? Have they thought about being a filmmaker? It might be a tricky career path, but there are some amazing success stories. We were speaking to Hind Shafani. She is the writer and editor of The Present, which has been nominated for an Oscar. So what's it like being a filmmaker during a pandemic, and will she be able to go to LA?
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Great to have you with us this afternoon. And I'm asking you, how many female delivery drivers have you come across here? Zero? Quite possibly? Me too. And that's why this story is so special. Meet Gift, female delivery driver at Freedom Pizza, possibly the first in Dubai. So do join the conversation. We'd love to hear from you. Gift, how are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. Hi, Ellen. Good afternoon.
Well, first of all, massive congratulations on the new job. Tell us a little bit about your story. Do you have your family here or family back home?
No, I don't. Thank you so much for the opportunity. I really appreciate it. My name is Gift. I am from Nigeria. I came to UAE about 5 years ago for greener pasture, of course, to search for a job, to help my family and also help myself improve as an individual. Before I came, I was in contact with an agent that was supposed to help me get a job. So I came to Dubai thinking I already had a job prepared for me, and I was like, okay, I'm just coming to resume. But when I came, that didn't work out. I had no job. I had to start all over. I was in the UAE for about 6 months without a job. So I was opportune to meet a friend that works close to Freedom Pizza at the Marina store. So one day she invited me over for a pizza, that she usually orders pizza and she gets a good discount from them. So I was like, okay, I'm going to join you for lunch today. So I came and she told me about an opportunity that I can get a job there, like they're hiring. So I sent my CV. So 6 months after searching for a job, Freedom came. I got interviewed and the next day I was called and they told me that I got the job already. Since then it's been... So since then it's been an amazing one. I've literally watched myself grow from a tribe member to a store trainer to a supervisor to an assistant manager and right now of course a driver, which I'm very proud to be, by the way. So
you should be. Gift, it's lovely to have a positive story to share at any time, never mind during a pandemic, and we are talking about job seekers this afternoon. So massive kudos to you. Did you ever think about this as a career for you?
Honestly speaking, initially no, but right now I am inspired by myself and I love the fact that I can inspire people and also do what I love doing, because trust me, right now, me working as a store as an assistant manager has actually helped me understand my drivers. Working with them has like actually exposed me, and me taking that up and saying, okay, I want to be a female delivery driver, despite the fact that I'm a lady. That people always say, okay, you're a lady, you should be limited to stuff that you can do. But right now, I see this as a career, and I intend to do it for a long time.
Good for you. And I love this as being a real role model and showing other women from all different nationalities and all different ages that there are options that perhaps they'd never even thought of. I'm a big believer that, you know, you can't be it unless you see it. And you're such a great example of that. Can I ask, what kind of reactions have you had when people have opened their door to get their pizza?
Oh, my goodness. It's been... I'm sorry, I can use the word crazy, but it's been awesomely amazing. Because most times when I deliver, I tend to see people, the laughter, some of them, they're dumbfounded, they can't say anything. And I can still remember a delivery I did. It was actually a party with friends. So when I got there, I introduced myself, hello, my name is Gift from Freedom Pizza, here's the order. Immediately the guy just opened the door, like, for his friends inside to actually see me. And when they saw me, they're like, they shouted, whoa. I was shy, nervous, but then I felt the fulfillment to see, like, okay, they were actually wowed seeing a female delivery driver deliver to them, which is really cool. I want to see that often. I want to order a pizza for myself and have a female delivery person delivers to me. Wouldn't you be excited to have someone deliver to you?
Me too. And, you know, I say this as someone, you know, before I got married, I lived on my own. And I it can be quite a strange experience with you when you're effectively inviting someone to your home and they might not walk through the door. But if you're a young woman on their own, to have a man come to the door, it can be a bit intimidating. And I think it would be amazing if more companies offered the option of a female delivery driver. I feel like a lot of women would feel a lot safer, to be honest. So I hope you are the first of many gifts. And can I just say, you've got the most perfect name. You really, really
thank
do.
Thank you, I know. Thank you so much.
It couldn't be better.
Thanks to my mama, I know, right?
She knew. We're going to speak to Ian now. Ian Ohan is the founder and chief executive of Crush Brands, which of course has Freedom Pizza. Ian, tell us a little bit about the process of hiring gifts. You actually the one that offered the job.
Well, Gift was hired through through our system, and Gift quickly came to her attention as she started to progress in her career. She moved very quickly, was promoted to supervisor, then assistant manager, and she's actually on track to become a manager of one of our stores towards the end of this year. And the kind of interesting backstory to this is we had a town hall, a company meeting just before COVID. We were all together, and I was talking about diversity and, you know, the idea that we need, you know, more females. And I kind of half-joked, I'd love to have a female delivery driver. And Gift just shot up from her chair, and she said, I'll do it. And that's sort of the history. That's how this sort of began. So that was kind of pretty cool. So we said, oh, well, let's do that. You know, and most of our general managers actually started as delivery drivers. So it's very much part of our culture, and it's an important milestone in Gift's journey to becoming a manager.
Gift, I wanted to ask you, what would you say to any women listening who might be looking for a job who perhaps hadn't considered being a delivery driver? What do they need to know? The pros and the cons, if you don't mind.
Okay, sure. Thank you, Radian. If you're listening this afternoon and you've been thinking or you're considering being a female delivery driver, I would say it's pretty much easy as you writing something on your to-do list and accomplishing them. Because as a female person, as a daughter, you shouldn't limit yourself. And being a female delivery driver for me, I'm so lucky to be with a company that actually provide all the safety measures. I mean, you're driving, you have the safety gears on, make sure you maintain the speed limits that you should. It's pretty much like driving a car. If you as a lady can drive a car, you can also deliver food, deliver pizza, or deliver whatever you want to deliver. But just make sure you're driving safe and also you're with the right company. A company that actually cares for you enough to make sure they provide all the safety measures that you need, the equipment and everything that you need. So if you're a lady, inspiring. I want to see more ladies on the streets. I really want to see more ladies on the streets.
Come on,
I
really ladies. Want to do that. Thanks, Gert.
I really need to see ladies. I want to say, hey, sister, where are you going? Where are you delivering to? And it's going to be fun. We can have a little picnic every now and then, you know?
Yes. Love it, Gift. Ian, I think Gift's point there about making sure you're working for or with a company that has safety at the forefront is so, so important. And we know what an essential service delivery drivers have been performing in general, but certainly the course of the last year. What kind of things are you doing to keep your staff safe right now?
Well, I think the most important thing is that we never rush on the road. You know, we don't incentivize our drivers by delivery. You know, they're not compensated by how quickly they deliver or anything like that. So, you know, we rush in our stores and, you know, our systems are set up so that we can dispatch a delivery in between 9 to 11 minutes. And so our drivers don't need to rush on the road. They don't make more money for being faster. In fact, we don't want that. We want them to drive safely. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, we, of course, make sure that they have all the right safety gear. I think, as you know, I'm a avid motorbike rider myself. And, you know, we made the decision very early on that if, you know, our driver shouldn't wear gear that I wouldn't wear myself, you know, that I wouldn't feel comfortable wearing. And so we basically came up with full gear, you know, full pack from, you know, DOT approved helmets to DOT approved armor, body armor, and everything they need to drive safely. We make sure their bikes are safe. We make sure that they have insurance. They have medical insurance, workman's compensation insurance. And we make sure, of course, that that they are trained to drive safely on the roads. And I can say that this is from my own observation, our drivers drive very safely on the road. I haven't seen any one of our drivers drive unsafely in a long time. We have a zero tolerance policy for reckless driving. But I do see other companies driving very recklessly. Mm-hmm. And if you see what happened during COVID, I mean, we had 12 delivery drivers die at a time when there was nobody on the road. And I presume they were rushing to make deliveries faster to make enough money to sustain themselves.
Ian, what can we do as Dubai citizens to make sure that delivery drivers are safer on the roads? What would be helpful for us as people behind the wheel of a car?
Yeah, one of the reasons we did this initial safety campaign, which, you know, we wanted to show people, you know, that these people that are on delivery bikes, you know, if we're going to take the time to make sure they're safe and they're driving safely, then, you know, we would like the public to be very careful with them as well. You know, because I think sometimes it's easy to think that they're just another vehicle on the road, but, you know, they've got two wheels, not four. They have they don't have a big steel structure around them. So, you know, the consequences to, something happening on the road on a motorbike are much more severe. Mm-hmm. And so we'd ask people to just be very mindful of our drivers on the road, give them space and treat them, you know, with the respect that their lives are, you know, at risk if something were to occur.
Ian, this is not related to employing female delivery drivers or indeed keeping people safe, but I think it comes back to that point of respect. And it's something that's been on my mind quite a lot over the course of the last year. And this is the fact that I don't really carry cash anymore, which makes me very aware that I need to make an effort when it comes to tipping at the petrol station or indeed when delivery drivers come. Are you taking any steps at Crush to make sure that your guys, but not the whole team, the guys and the girls, are getting the tips that they deserve when people perhaps aren't carrying the cash that they used to and everything is going through contactless payments? How can we make sure they're not missing out?
Sure, 100%. So we actually, on our apps now, when you order from us directly at freedompizza.ae, or download our apps, you can tip directly, and you can also rate our drivers as well, which we're always excited to get feedback from our drivers. But you can tip directly online through your credit card payment. To be honest, I initially was a bit against this because I believe that it's our job to look after our drivers. But during COVID, I think, to your point, a lot of people wanted to tip, but they didn't want to use cash. Mm-hmm. And so we provided that service. So you can tip online, and our drivers received 100% of all tips.
And are you looking to recruit any more female drivers? It sounds like Gift is absolutely rocking it on the role model front. More to follow in her footsteps?
So we would love, and I'll take this opportunity, maybe this is the right time to do it. This is an open call to all females who are want to be food delivery drivers. We will help them get their licenses. We would love to have more female delivery drivers, and managers and pizza makers and phone operators. And we have multiple brands now. So we would love to have more female drivers. So this is a call to all females who ever thought they might want to ride a motorbike and deliver food. If you come to Crush Brands and Freedom Pizza, we'll hook you up.
Ian, thank you so much. And Gift, wishing you all the very best. I hope you deliver to Jumeirah because I'd love to have you at the door. Take care, you guys. Really appreciate it. And lots of you getting in touch saying you have spotted some female delivery drivers around and about Dubai. Steph saying the gorgeous flower company have a female delivery driver. It's great to see women here doing male-dominated jobs. I love the gorgeous flower company. Apparently Amazon do too. And Troy saying about female delivery drivers, I'm so happy to hear management's thoughts on driver safety. Delivery drivers around Motor City, Studio City all act like roads on NASCAR. I'll be ordering from Freedom Pizza in the future. And if, as Ian said, if you are a woman out there looking to work in this industry, whether it is making pizza as assistant manager or getting out on your bike, get in touch. We'd love to connect you with the team at Crush Brands. And that's Crush with a K if you do want to Google and have a chat with them.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Speaking now to Andy Phillips. He is from the University of Wollongong, and we are talking about career mentorship. So do you have a career mentor? We're going to be discussing why it's important to have someone who can help you towards that career path of your dreams, maybe getting you a higher salary, helping you make the right decisions. Here is a tip from leadership expert and author Robin Sharma.
Be willing to be eccentric. You know, you can be like the 95%, or you can play in rare air. You can't do both. And if you are going to play in rare air, then that means you're going to shift from the belief system and the mindsets and the heart sets of the majority.
Robin Sharma there. Do recommend his books, and delighted to be joined now. Andy Phillips with us. He's the Chief Operating Officer at the University of Wollongong here in Dubai. How are you, Andy, this afternoon?
I'm good, thanks, Helen. How are you doing?
I'm all right. I'm holding up. Distance learning with my daughter, so I look about 80 years old, but we're still friends. So that's I'll take that as a win. I love the idea of a mentor, to be honest. And one of the big concerns that I think a lot of companies have had, especially when it comes to recruiting fresh grads, is the fact that people are working from home means there isn't that opportunity to learn via osmosis, that to listen to colleagues around you and pick up whether that is, you know, sales techniques or certain language around a particular industry. And this is where the idea of a dedicated mentor can be really, really beneficial. But I'd love you, first of all, to define what a mentor is. Can anyone become one? And what do you see that role encompassing?
Well, I think a mentor fills a gap in your skill set. I mean, he looks at you and identifies what's missing and what could be enhanced and improved, and he works to help you fill those gaps. And last week the Harvard Business Review said that there's a massive gap between the skills that are taught in universities and what the gaps that employers are looking mm-hmm. for. There's a recent survey, Manpower survey in the US of 2,000 employers, and over 50% of them said that, you know, a mentor could help, develop problem-solving skills or collaboration, customer service and communication. And I think that that's incredibly important for somebody on the outside to look at you and say, okay, well, potentially we need to work on that particular part of your persona and your behaviours. The likes of modern companies now like Google and Amazon are citing curiosity as being a really desired skill in fresh graduates. And these are the things that aren't necessarily taught in a degree program. So there is a definite need for somebody to sit down alongside students who are doing their degrees and to work with them on developing the personal side of being an employee mm-hmm. and making them workplace ready.
I think that is so true. You know, we unfortunately can't. There's no way necessarily of equipping someone to be hitting the ground running when they graduate. But to have some involvement, some insights about what life is like, you know, post-graduation is absolutely key. You know, many of us might have found a mentor and a boss, a senior colleague. I mean, when I worked in sales after graduating, sitting opposite this guy, and I, you know, Mike Kearney to this day was incredible, but I would just sit and watch him sell advertising space like an absolute boss. And I learned so much from literally eavesdropping on his conversations. But these are organic relationships that come up from the workplace. There are other ways, less organic, but certainly meaningful ways to find a mentor, where you're almost matchmaking students with experts who can guide them towards their career path. You know, tell us what's happening at your university.
Well, we're working on behaviours, believe it or not. So it's not just about skills. So to quote one of my mentors, Simon Sinek, skills can be taught, but you employ for attitude. So we look at behaviours and attitudes and see what is lacking in that particular understanding of those aspects of people's personalities. So behaviour just as important as skills, and companies like Thomas International's and Myers-Briggs have done studies that map behaviours against even certain industries. So if you're looking at a career in banking and finance, you need to have huge amounts of compliance and interpersonal compatibility or competence with dealing with people. Or if you're looking at consulting, IT, research and science, you require people with high degrees of drive. So these are things that basically, if you don't have that interpersonal connectivity at the moment with the COVID pandemic affecting many of our lives, there are online resource portals that are able to actually help you mentor yourself through this period. It's so important to know how you behave and how you interact with other people and how they behave and how they interact. And that's a thing that's really quite missing in what we teach at the university. So I think, as I said, I think that programs that run alongside this is incredibly important. And we've developed a program that starts with psychometric analysis of students. And it goes right the way through to how you set your goals, your objectives, how you communicate, and also the pitfalls of the modern workplace with things like gender and race bias. Mm. Avoiding those pitfalls and make sure you don't fall into those traps.
So the University of Wollongong does have that program called The Edge, and you've been in touch and are working with some top-notch mentors from a number of different fields. Can you tell us about some of the mentors you've chosen for that program? And where was my phone call, Andy? Jeez.
I'm sure we'll be able to rope you into the program. There's no problem whatsoever. But we've got a great behavioural scientist that deal in psychometrics. So we've got a guy called John Gage who's been working with the likes of HSBC and a lot of the advertising agency people around the world to help people understand who they are and how they interact. But moving on from that, we've had a serial entrepreneur, a guy called John Duchinsky, who's worked with the US government in terms of things like screen addiction, and he's even he's built a bug farm, would you believe, to try and solve a problem of world fishing problems. So these are the type of behavioral scientists that they're lending themselves their skills. We've got communication experts, a couple of BBC journalists that help us analyze the way that we communicate with people and build our own personal brand and how we relay our key messaging to our audiences, like working with our teams and working with our bosses. And then we've also got a young lady who's quite famous in this part of the world called Nima Abawarda, who used to be the front face of BBC Middle East. Mm-hmm. And that's something that she's very, very passionate about, gender bias and sustainability in the workplace. So we've collaborated with a lot of global individuals who are quite famous in their field to be able to give our students the benefit of being able to interact with these famous people, to get their experience and find out how they went through their life so that they can learn from that.
Can I ask, Andy, what's the end goal here? You know, how can you track their progress as they move out into the wild, real world?
Well, our parents are telling us that really that they're seeing their children's education as some degree of return on investment. So I hope so as well. Our end goal is to make sure that our students, when they graduate, have the best possibility to get the highest earning job and enter the job market at the highest level, and also a job that they're actually happy with.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that. I was like, Andy, please, we don't want a bunch of really miserable but really wealthy people. We want a happy society too. So striking that balance is absolutely key. And to have insights from someone who is actually living it, working in it, and has something to share, I think is really important. But whether it is a grad or someone who is in the middle or even the later stages of their career, I think we can all benefit from some outside insights, some fresh perspectives, and always worth having a conversation because we can learn from people in the most unexpected ways. Andy, thank you so much. Wishing you and everyone at the University of Wollongong all the very best. I'm excited to see what comes out of these relationships. I think it's a fantastic, fantastic initiative.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We love to talk careers, and at the moment there are an awful lot of job seekers out there who are looking for their next move, whether that is getting a job from scratch or indeed looking for a promotion. Delighted to be joined now by Krishma, who has been in the UA for 7 years and is looking for a role. Krishma, thank you so much for being with us. Can you tell us a little bit about what you've been doing over the last few years?
Well, I came to Dubai in 2013, once I had finished my graduation, post-graduation and all of that. And when I came here back then, looking for a job was pretty much easy because I'm in the hospitality industry. And being in the hospitality industry, that time it was booming. Mm-hmm. And getting a job was very easy. And believe me, if people don't believe me when I say this, but I really got my first job by calling through the Yellow Pages. I called every travel agent and tour operators, and I started calling them one by one. And in my fifth call, I got my first company. And that's how I started working with Lamar Holidays, which was my first job. Back then, I worked with them for 3 years. It was fun because, you know, getting to know the market. And I was not that young. I was 24. Still, it was a very good experience working with that company. As of now, I am looking for a job, yes. And if it was in the hospitality industry, it would be great because I'm good in what I do. My background is sales. I've always been in sales since I've been here. So as of now, I'm looking for a job in any field because hospitality has taken a big hit since the pandemic started. I really hope for the best. I've given I don't know how many interviews and applied God knows in how many companies. I am really hoping for the best. I do have a couple of interviews lined up, but I get silly reasons for not getting hired. I go up till the round of CEO, and then I still don't get hired because they think that I cannot deal with certain type of people when it comes to sales.
Interesting. So, Krishma, can I ask you, what is it about sales that you enjoy? What keeps you interested and engaged? And, you know, what do you think you bring to the table as well?
In sales, you meet so many kind of different people. And that's what I enjoy. I like talking to different people, getting to know their needs. Probably being in the service industry is what I like because sitting in an office and working is not something that I enjoy. And I'm a chatterbox, so I keep talking the whole day and sitting in an office in front of a computer and working the whole day, speaking to no one is not my cup of tea. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the reason why I chose being in sales. I think I'm good at it. I think I speak pretty well. Although I'm an Indian, sometimes people do think that I have a weird accent, probably a regional accent. As long as I can convey what I have to, I don't think it's a problem.
Krishma, thank you so for your honesty. I really, really do appreciate it. And I think it just goes to show, you know, you've been looking so hard. You mentioned how many interviews, how many CVs you've sent off. Can I ask a bit of a difficult question? You know, have you put in mind a timeline that if you can't get a job here in the UAE, you know, would you think about going home to India? Do you have a plan? What are you thinking?
Well, honestly speaking, I do not want to go back to India. Not that there aren't any great opportunities there. Of course there are. But since the beginning of my career, I have been here. So going back to India means starting from a scratch. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I don't know the market there. The hospitality market back in India is completely and totally different from the market that is in the UAE. For all you know, it probably is easier there. I've never tried. So I don't know. And yes, I am on a timeline only because as of now, I'm almost, I've ran out of my savings. I am living with my friend. and I had to give up on the apartment that I was staying in. And sometimes it's depressing because, you know, you've been struggling all your life since you've been here. Finally, you think that you reached a particular level, and, you know, going back to job hunting and taking this long, it takes this long, which has never taken this long. I've always given 3 interviews and I've cracked one. I have never been through such a situation where I have been getting rejected for stupid reasons, or some people, they just don't get back to you. And yes, so I kept a timeline for myself, thinking that if probably I don't, you know, get a job or at least an offer letter in hand by the time it's Ramadan, mm-hmm. then I think I just go back to India, lock, stock and barrel, and probably try a different country, or maybe just try my luck back in India.
What you're speaking of is something people all over listening will be nodding along to, that horrible sense of rejection and dejection and how it does grind you down. It really does. You know, I've been there, and it's that sense of identity and wanting to feel like you're contributing is so, so important. It sounds, in honesty, like you've got a great attitude and loads to offer. You do have a background, yeah. as you say, in the hospitality industry, but sales, you know, tourism as well. Can I ask you some really kind of practical things, like, you know, driver's license, computer, you know, software that you're familiar with, so it might, you know, jog some memories or, you know, spark something in anyone listening who might have a role that's suitable?
Of course. Well, I do have a driver's license, but I had to give up on my car when I went back to India last year because, you know, it wasn't practical to keep the car here because I didn't know at that point of time if I was returning. So I do have a driving license, and I've been driving for the past 2 years, although I got my license really late. I'm fairly good at computers, if you go to see. We do have, like, in sales, even if you're in sales and you're out the whole day, but having a basic knowledge of, I think, Microsoft Office is really important. I do know Microsoft Office really well. I have reports that you have to do. You need to do your maintain some Excel sheets, get Word documents, probably send a PDF draft of a contract to any of your clients. So I have been doing that. So I do have basic knowledge of everything that's needed for a sales job, unless the company that probably I might join hopefully has a different kind of software which will need a little brushing up. Yeah. I will have to, of course, brush that up. At the end of the day, you need to get your targets. That's what sales is all about.
Absolutely.
And that's what keeps you going.
And as you've said, happy to work in across any industry. So if you are looking for a people person, a strong salesperson, driver's license, great on the old Microsoft Office, and willing to learn any software that you might have in your company, please get in touch. We've got Krishma's details. She'd love to stay here in the UAE. And if you have a role for her, just get in touch. 4001. Krishma, thank you so much for your time today. Sending you all the good vibes. And
thank you, Helen.
I think it's so important to be having these conversations. And here at Dubai, we want to do a bit of matchmaking. We are going to be hearing next from a company that does have some roles. But if anyone's listening and thinks that Krishma would be a good fit for the company, get in touch so we can connect you. Krishma, thank you so much. Really, really appreciate your time this afternoon.
You're welcome, Helen, for this opportunity.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Now time to speak to an employer who's looking to fill a position. Delighted to be joined on the line by Injil Moti, the founder of Catch Comms. They are looking for someone, well, a dream candidate. Injil, before we talk about what you're looking for, can you tell us a little bit about your company and what you do?
Hi, Alan. How are you?
I am well, thank you. And I'm very encouraged that people are indeed hiring during the time, especially a company like yours. What do people need to know about Catch?
So we are a boutique lifestyle communications consultancy, and we do quite a bit of work in the marketing space here, say with lifestyle brands. So our clients are typically fashion, beauty, health, wellness, a lot of female entrepreneurs as well. And we do pretty much everything under the sun when it comes to marketing. So from public relations, social media, events, influencer marketing, you know, the whole deal. So definitely looking for a candidate that, you know, that's got experience, that's creative, you know, can communicate, can write very well. So these are some of the things that we are looking out for.
So what is the position that you're looking to fill specifically?
So we're looking to fill in the role of a senior account executive. We've got somebody that's moving on from the company, and we're looking to fill in that role. So I would say it's more mid-management level.
And what about the responsibilities that they will be undertaking?
dealing with clients, writing quite a bit of press releases, dealing with the press, with editors, pitching in stories, coming up with ideas and creative campaigns, etc. So quite a mixed bag.
So lots of variety. And I think there's a bit of a myth around media and PR that it's all glamour. There is a bit of a swanky side, but there's an awful lot of legwork and long hours involved. Can you kind of lift the lid a little bit on what happens behind the scenes?
No, a whole lot. And I'm so glad you asked that, because we get a lot of candidates who come in and who apply, you know, looking at our Instagram page and similarly, you know, with other agencies in the region. And, you know, while it appears like it's all glitz and glam, that's really not the case. So there's quite a bit of the admin work involved. There's quite a bit of, behind the scenes stuff that nobody really seen. So what people see is the event that we produce on the day, but the work that goes behind it, whether it's, you know, carrying bags from the Dubai Mall parking to the store, or, you know, for instance, clipping all those, clipping is more of an industry term, but, you know, just looking up on everyone's social media channels, whatever you say, your brand is tagged, you know, just keeping a record of that, putting that on a file and things like that. So there's quite a bit of admin work, and the role that we're currently looking to fill in would involve that as well. We're usually very transparent when we're interviewing candidates, but yes, while you do have the rosy side, there's also this side that goes in, to the role.
And what kind of experience would the ideal candidate have, Angel?
We're looking for someone young and vibrant, and, you know, somebody who understands new age marketing, because that's quite a bit of what we do here at Catchcoms. But somebody, say, with 2 to 3 years of experience, preferably in the region. Really just somebody with the right attitude who's looking to learn and grow.
And do you have a timeline in mind? When do you need to fill this position by?
I would say yesterday, but...
yes, it's a fast-moving industry.
Yes, as soon as possible. Yeah, we're speaking to quite a few lovely candidates, but definitely would love to be more, as we're growing quite extensively as well with the agency. So ideal start date is April, May.
Okay, fantastic. And if someone's listening and thinks, I am that dream candidate, I am young and vibrant and hardworking, and I'm happy to fill goodie bags as well as deal with clients and influencers and deal with the admin as well, what is awesome. The best way of getting in touch with you at Catchcoms?
We've got the Instagram page, we've got our email and all the other details there. We usually post our vacancies there as well. Or you can come through our LinkedIn as well, yeah, social media.
Brilliant. Thank you so much again, and you'll really appreciate it. As I said, fantastic to hear about hiring at this time, and good to see that clients are active again, spending again, and maybe some more events in the future. COVID appropriate events, of course. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. And we will absolutely be in touch with you, Angel, if someone comes through the text line. So it's 4001. If you can drop us a quick line, we can connect you with Angel Moti. They're the founder of Catchcoms. Maybe you know someone who is the perfect fit for that company. So they're looking for a senior account executive working in public relations, marketing, influencer marketing, events. So really just a good all-rounder, ideally with some regional experience and a bit of glitz and glam, but yes, an awful lot of hard work as well. So get in touch with us now, 4001, if you think this could be you.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking jobs and job seeking this afternoon. Speaking now to industry insider Shane Phillips, the MD of the Phillips Group, as we look behind the headlines. Remote working visas, a new announcement that came out yesterday. Shane, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. How are you doing?
I am very well. Very intrigued about what this announcement means, though, and I'm hoping you can help clear up any confusion, answer any questions that are coming in on 4001 or the ARN Play app. What is it all about? What is this new remote work visa system that has been approved?
Well, it looks like, you know, as we kind of move forward in the post-COVID world, that people working from home, and then the question mark starts to be raised in the boardroom is, you know, if people aren't going to be in the office, do we really care where they are? And you're seeing clients now have gone from sending their finance departments to work from home to saying, well, why do we need to have a finance department in this country? And maybe we have a team that's spattered across different geographies, but virtually connected. And I think that looks like the direction that people are going, allowing them to deliver cost-effective solutions to their human capital needs.
It's a really interesting move, and actually something that I saw a couple of weeks ago when some friends of mine left keeping their jobs here in Dubai, but they're going to be working from Europe instead. We're seeing it on a different scale with students who might not be having their student experience, whether that's in the UK or the US, and studying from here in Dubai, doing unusual hours, but showing that it is absolutely popular. So this means that Dubai continues to be a global talent hub. We're still going to get the high quality employees. It just means they might not be based right here in the city. So such professionals can reside in the Emirates, even if their companies are based in another country, and will allow people to work globally from Dubai as well. So what does it mean in terms of freelancers and perhaps the willingness of companies to use freelancers?
I think now companies are more willing to use freelancers than ever before. And we've actually seen some of our clients go as far as saying, well, why don't we just outsource our entire finance department, where normally, you know, finance has been one of the cards you want to hold closer to your chest.
Mm-hmm.
So the willingness has actually gone further than we've expected. It's really kind of touching departments which were historically sacred and highly confidential. They're now looking at outsourcing. So I think the opportunity is really massive for freelancers. And I think the other thing that's really also driving it, not only do millennials love being freelancers, but you have this huge cohort of, you know, the 55 plus crowd that may have been let go or restructured, and it may be hard for them to get back into the full-time workflow. They are working as freelancers, and so there's a huge population of freelancers now that are available, and companies are more willing than ever to use them. But I just would caution that, you know, I think the long-term effects for the organizations, where, you know, if you're running your company from an Excel sheet, it may look like a good idea to, you know, all of a sudden use these lower cost options. But in the long run, you know, I think that you will be definitely hurting your ability to be strategic, your ability to innovate. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, I'm really a firm believer that full-time employees are much more likely to contribute to innovation, to corporate citizenship, to new strategies than freelancers will. And, you know, you look at, you know, success stories like spicy Cheetos. You know, we've all eaten spicy Cheetos. For Cheetos, it was the biggest product ever made. That was created by the janitor who was working in the Cheeto factory, and at night he took some leftover Cheetos and he spiced them up and you know, passed them out. You look at Tide from P&G, one of their landmark product lines was created by an engineer working in the factory. So that kind of frugal innovation, the person tinkering with the production line, the person in the heat of the kitchen, you're removing that person. You know, are you really losing your ability to innovate? And that would be my main question, because, you know, freelancers aren't going to have the same commitment to the brand.
No, exactly. The level of investment, the involvement in company culture, even the same types of, you know, communication, it is definitely compromised. So whether that is a long-term kind of solution or not, it remains to be seen. But I absolutely hear what you're saying. And give the janitor a medal. Spicy Cheetos for the win. Who says? Not all superheroes wear capes. Sometimes they wear a janitor's uniform.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Delighted to be joined now by Shane Phillips, MD of the Phillips Group, as we talk recruitment. And we heard earlier from Karishma, who is looking for a sales role, is spending morning, noon and night sending off CVs, having interviews and saying she's been declined for, so what she says are, you know, some quite silly reasons. And we're hearing, Shane, from a lot of job seekers that they're simply being ghosted, actually. You know, why do employers never call back, and what ultimately should applicants do? So that's what I want to put to you. What happens when that phone just doesn't ring?
Well, I think firstly, you really need to be passionate and excited about what you're doing and come to the table with a lot of energy and create a nexus, create a connection with your interviewer, create that relationship, find those common interests, and make a connection as a human being first and as a job applicant second. And I think the second thing that you want to do is during your interview, understand what the key issues are. You know, what are they really hiring you to solve? What is the main key issue, key problems, key initiatives, things that they want to overcome? So, for example, if we're hiring a chief human resource officer, you know, do we have a major comp and ben issue? If yes, then after the interview, approach it more like a business consultant and say, oh, you know, hey, I really love speaking with you. By the way, you mentioned that there was some comp and ben challenges. Here's a couple case studies of Fortune 100 companies who had similar issues. This is what they did. Here's what I think about it. By the way, if you'd love to have another chat about it, I'm free next week, Wednesday.
No, I was saying need to be going above and beyond. I love that human connection as well, because, you know, if this pandemic's taught us anything, I think humanity is absolutely coming to the fore. And what we're realizing is we want to work with people that we like. Yes, they might be able to deliver, but, you know, it's that coming back to that company culture, especially during hard times, to be surrounded by people who have the right attitude is really, really key. And not just having the right attitude to what their individual role is, but to the industry, to be, you know, a thought leader, someone whose name is going to be a real credit to, you know, that team page on your website.
Yes, and have that spark when they say there's a problem. Say, hey, here's three things. This is how I would tackle it. Here's three things I would do to solve the problem. Here's a case study of two top performing companies who had a similar problem. Here's what they did. And by the way, why don't I send you a couple PowerPoints on this? And then, you know, a lot of times candidates are scared to share their ideas because they're so afraid people are going to steal them. Mm-hmm. And I would say just be a wellspring of ideas and just share it and give them insight, give them a vision. You want to create a vision of what it would be like if you were in this role. If we hired Jennifer for this job, what would that look like? And make that crystal clear that you're a problem solver. And I think that's part of what people are lacking lots of times. You walk away and, you know, in the follow-up, there's no additional deposits. You know, there's mm-hmm. no freebie. You know, if you look at, you know, these online sales programs, when you go there, you know, a week later, they'll be like, oh, here's your free ebook on this topic or whatnot. Well, you need your freebie. You need to come back a week later and say, hey, here's a couple other ideas. I've digested our conversation. Here's a few ideas I had.
I love that. And at the moment, it's a bit of a tricky time when it comes to networking and events. But there are some things that are still going on, especially within specific organizations. And getting involved and, as you kind of put it, being an influencer within your job and part of your industry is another great way to stand out at all levels.
Absolutely. I mean, I think you should really love what you do, have a huge value for the profession, and have that sense of identity and purpose. And so when you're in the meeting, then you know, there will be other industry events. Say, for example, as you said, because it's COVID, maybe we can't go to the, you know, live event, but maybe there's a new book that's been released. And you say, you know, hey, by the way, as part of the CHRO Social Club, you know, we're celebrating the launch of that new book by XYZ. We're having a virtual call about it if you want to join. And now you're creating, you know, a sense of a purpose, of meaning that's beyond the job. And you're contributing that person's growth and development. And you're also signaling that, hey, I'm a leader in this industry. I'm a leader in this profession. And it doesn't matter how senior or junior you are, because you have fresh graduates who actually are organizing events and who are also very powerful in terms of making the industry connect. Mm-hmm. And I think that is one of the core areas also people lack. You want to show leadership. You want to show initiative. You want to show passion. You want to show excitement. So, you know, get involved in helping your industry and promote your industry. And these are great ways to follow up.
Love
you know, with,
Shane,
with people.
Always food for thought, always a fresh perspective, and a bit of a re-energizing, I think, way of looking at job hunting when so many people are feeling down and despondent and a bit hopeless. So hopefully shifted a bit of a mindset there, given some great ideas, and looking forward to speaking to you very, very soon. It is a very interesting time when it comes to recruitment, so we'd love to have you back, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure. I just want to leave one last quick tip before we go.
Go for
it. Is that come to the table with a huge excitement because, yes, it is COVID and, you know, it might have been a frosty time, but we're on the precipice of one of the biggest booms that we've ever seen as this economy comes back and the vaccines are rolled out. You know, whether that's going to happen in June or it's going to happen in September, you know, it's coming and there's going to be a massive boom. So you should be really excited about it. And at the front end of your interview, talk about that. Talk about how amazing, you know, this new era is going to be and how excited you are about it. And don't talk about, yeah, you know, whether it was negative or anything that's not exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the real way to look at it. And that's a fact. I can guarantee you that in 6 to 7 months, you're going to see one of the most vibrant economies here in the UAE. You're going to see a phenomenal amount of job growth, and you're going to see work and jobs taking place in ways we never thought we even thought of before. So you should be really excited about it.
So bring the energy, bring the boom. Really appreciate it, Shane. Take care of yourself.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Asking you this afternoon, do you have any student loans? Are you still paying them off? I paid mine off about 4 years ago, and it was a bittersweet moment because, well, it sounds terrible. After experiencing some pretty awful customer service on the phones here in the region, it was a genuine delight to call the student loans company in Scotland. They were so friendly, they seemed to really care, and it was excellent, excellent customer service. But my days, it took me, oh my goodness, what, 15 years to pay off my student loan? And I was expecting, you know, a nice note saying, congratulations. No, nothing. It just faded off into ether. The reason it took me so long, because I was earning so little in the UK. I was basically paying off the equivalent of about 100 dirhams a month. So what about you? Are you still paying yours off? Would the threat of debt actually lead you to discourage your children from going to university? We've been speaking to some of our colleagues, asking Chris McCarty, where does he stand with his debt?
I still have them, but of course it's just burying my head in the sand. That's why I've moved to Dubai. There's a lot of sand out here. Huge debt has mounted up. The rumour is that if you come to Dubai, you run away from it, Helen, which I know you've given me the thumbs down is not the case. I will get round to it eventually.
Come on, McCarty, sort it out. What about Natasha from the ARN News team?
No, never. In India, parents pay for our education, so I'm ashamed to say that my parents have paid for my education and I didn't have to rack up any loans.
And what does Nick think?
I think that student debt can be absolutely crippling, and it can have the potential of making people choose any job just to pay back the debt rather than really thinking about their career. I think the best course of action is to identify the right career choice, maybe spend some time working, see what makes most sense, and then perhaps pursue any kind of degree in and around work that allows you to keep earning and minimize your debt. But, you know, when you hear these horror stories of people that basically have to pay off a mortgage before they can get a mortgage, oh, come on, it's no good for anyone.
So where do you stand? Are you like Chris, running away from or still paying off your student loans? Or Natasha, who didn't have any tuition loans to begin with? Or sensible, like my good husband there, Nick Farmer? So many of us under pressure to pay off student loans. And a global survey says today's university students want things to change. We're joined online now by Mark Boxter, who is the Vice President of Policy and Communications at Chegg. Mark, thank you so, so much for being with us. Can you tell us a little bit, first of all, about Chegg and its research arm, chegg.org?
Yeah, my pleasure, Helen. So nice to be with you and all your listeners. Chegg is an online education technology company. We're one of the largest, not the largest in the world, and we provide a suite of services to help really college-age students get through college and get a job. And Chegg.org is our nonprofit arm, and we really did this survey. I think it's the largest of its kind, 17,000 students around the world, to really understand the issues they're facing, especially given the global pandemic. So, you know, it's been a sea change in education over the last year. We like to say it's probably actually been an acceleration of trends that mm-hmm. have already been going on for a long time. So that's us. I'm really honored to be here. Thank you.
Well, you're very welcome. I think that's a really interesting point about the pandemic serving as a catalyst to things that might have been brewing for some time. And the survey covered many aspects of education right now and revealing a majority of students actually want more online learning even after the pandemic,
Correct.
Which surprised me. What about you?
It doesn't surprise me at all because, you know, we're based in Silicon Valley, and the one thing that technology has proven to be very good at is lowering the cost of things and opening up the access. So when you look at what's happening in higher education, more people want education. They want a different kind of education. They want something that's closer linked to the job market, but they definitely, to the point that you've been covering all morning, want it to be more affordable. And online education has proven that we can actually do things at a much more affordable price. So, you know, if you think about it, you get your TV shows, your movies on Netflix, you no longer have to pay to go to a cinema, you want a taxi, you can order a ride share service, you don't have to go stand in the street anymore. So students want the same thing. They say, why can't my education come to me at the time and place of my choosing in a much more targeted and individualized way? And that's, we're not there yet, but that's what the promise of online education is.
I absolutely see the benefits of this, and I love that kind of pick and mix approach, that more flexible. And maybe I'm stuck in the dark ages, by which I mean I went to university in the year 2000, where I think of university being 3 years of a mix of academics, but honestly, a good bit of the social side as well, down the student union and making friends and, you know, having probably a bit too much fun, as my degree classification would probably testify. And I feel like I've seen quite a lot of sadness from students recently, that they're perhaps not getting the student experience that they had initially been looking forward to. But maybe we just need to stop thinking about further education in that way altogether. And can we crunch the numbers on what came back from this survey, Mark? You know, 31% of students. Yeah, can you give us some of the things? Because
yeah, absolutely. So it's interesting. So I think what we don't have to think about is an either-or approach. Mm-hmm. You know, you went to school for 3 years. I grew up in the UK. I was the same. But why do you have to live on a campus for all 3 years? Why not go for 1 year? And then if you want to spend your second and third year somewhere else or somewhere more affordable, why shouldn't that be an option? When we look at the numbers, what's fascinating is that 65% or more of students want some kind of online education going forward. But they don't actually, when we asked about do you actually want online education from your institution, it was a little over half. So there's a slight gap there that I think is actually really about how each institution deployed it. Some students had a really good experience and some probably not so much. So the universities to some degree have to learn how to educate online. There is a difference between online learning and remote learning. Online is actually, there are online universities that do this extremely well. So we do know how to do it. The other thing is overwhelmingly students would take either more online education or shorter a number of years to get a degree if it made university more affordable.
Yes.
So definitely what you're seeing more and more is students looking for a better return on investment on their higher education. And overwhelmingly, I think it's about 80%, if I remember from the survey, students look to go to university to get a job. That is their primary goal. So while the freshers week and all of that, but it's great, you know, at the end of it, it has to be linked to a good job. And the final piece is what we're seeing is overwhelming amount of anxiety and stress. Not surprisingly, we've all experienced it during this terrible pandemic. And a lot of it relates to finances. Mm-hmm. So, you know, 1 in 3 students around the world, doesn't sound like a lot, but it's a huge number of students, never think they'll pay off their student debt, which is astounding to me.
That is frightening, to be honest. And as the mum of 2 young kids, it does raise the question, you know, would I be keen for them to get me or them into that amount of debt when we haven't got that guaranteed return? Anonymous message here saying, I have a senior and won't let him take loans. He is going online. I still have loans. And I feel like there are certain parts of the world, Mark, where the amount of debt is nauseating, to be honest. And America, I'm looking at you. You know, we heard earlier, you know, paying off the equivalent of a mortgage before you can afford to get a mortgage. It's very sobering indeed, and I think has led to many families thinking about that return on investment and what does make financial sense in order to, yes, have a good time, but also, you know, be able to specialise in your field, get the education you need in order to get a job in what could be a very, very challenging job market over the next couple of years. Now, one thing that really caught my eye in the survey was the financial stress and how it's affecting them outside of the classroom. Over a third, so 35% of students surveyed who have a student loan said they lose sleep over it. 21% saying it makes them so anxious that they've sought medical help. That is so upsetting, right, to be honest.
Yeah, it's terrible. It's a tremendous amount of stress and anxiety to people really trying to start out in life, start out their careers. They're not entirely sure what maybe they want to do in life. Many, in some cases, are living away from home for the first time. So, you know, like students are, you know, very similar to adults, and financial stress is brutal on us adults. And not surprisingly, it's very much the same for university students.
And more than half surveyed across all countries have struggled with their living costs over the last year. 23% have struggled with their rent or mortgage payments, with utility bills, food and, you know, medical treatment and services. And it just kind of breaks my heart, to be honest, at a time where you should be focusing on your studies and having fun and, yes, making some mistakes, but they shouldn't be financial mistakes. You know, there's got to be a better way. There, you know, there really, really does. So what young students really want is a cheaper higher education in a shorter period of time and some online learning factored in. I thought it was interesting your point earlier about, was it 63% of students wanting an online element, but only around half wanting it from their institution. Could there be an opportunity then for you to study with a university that, you know, you might not be able to ever need to step foot on, that might specialise in exactly the course you want, but you can't get to South America, or you couldn't afford to live in Copenhagen? Right. What opportunities could there be there?
Yeah, I think, we can do this well in the same way the United States is sadly probably the leader in student debt. It's also one of the leaders in online education, and there's some phenomenal online institutions. I'm thinking of Southern New Hampshire, which has hundreds of thousands of students, mainly online. They don't do remote learning. They do online education, which means their classes are small. They're organized around an online experience. They don't do graduate research. That's a great thing for universities to do, but they really focus on undergraduates, and they focus on getting students in jobs. So when I think when we look about after this pandemic, what we're going to start to see is more of a bifurcation of what a university is. You'll start to see some go in one direction, and we're going to be very much research universities doing incredible work to sort of further mankind, further academia. We're going to start to see sort of very high-end universities. I think kids are always going to want to go to Harvard or Oxford or Stanford. But we're going to start to see more and more universities go a different direction and start to say, let's really lower the price, and let's really work closely with companies about what skills students need, and start to almost be not apprenticeships. I think there'll still be university experience there, but much closer tied to what the outcomes are.
Mark, can I ask you a personal question? Actually, I'm going to ask you two personal questions. Do you have any? Just because I've got you on the phone. Do you have any student debt yourself now?
Well, I went to university very slightly before you did. So I actually was, I think I was the last year in England when tuition was paid for by your local council.
Good for you.
I did go to graduate school in America, and I did have student debt from that, despite the fact I had a full scholarship just from living costs and some, you know, I only paid that off, let me think, 13 years after I graduated. And that compared to most Americans, was a tiny amount. Mm-hmm. So we've seen in the States what a crippling experience student debt can be for many, you know, for many, many young people.
And can I ask you, if you were to do it all again in 2021, would you go to university?
I would definitely go to university. I'd probably have left earlier and gone into the job market earlier. I think, you know, when I look at my career, I had a fantastic university experience, but, you know, a lot of what I do, I didn't learn at university. I learned on the job. Mm-hmm. I learned from, you know, my bosses and my peers.
And then that's exactly what we were speaking earlier about the importance of having a mentor. And I feel like distance working has really taken away the opportunity from so many people just to learn by, you know, by sheerly being in the office together and learning from people who've been in the job, whether that is techniques or lexicon or whatever that might be. And I really hope that we're able to continue to blend in some way. If people want to read more about that survey, Mark, what's the best way of looking at the numbers?
Yeah, they can go to chegg.org, which is our nonprofit arm. I really encourage you to look at it. And the other thing, if I could just say, is it's really a great time to champion students right now. They've been through a lot. We're actually partnering with the Varki Foundation, which comes out of Dubai, to create a student prize where we're going to fit $50,000 to one amazing student to really shine a spotlight on what students have been through this year. So if you have students in your lives, I really encourage you to, you know, get behind them, give them a little pep talk, because they really need help right now.
Couldn't couldn't agree more. Mark, really, really appreciate your time this afternoon. It's Chegg.org to find out more. Hearing from you guys about your experiences regarding student debt. And yes, America was name checked several times in the last half hour as being one of the most expensive places to get an education. Leisha is one of those Americans. She's got a son going to college and she's still paying off her own student loans.
My student loans took a backseat to all of the other expenses of life. And just paying the minimums and just interest payments and forbearances. And unfortunately, as an American, I think this is a mindset that's been ingrained in all of us, that student loans don't really matter. They'll just magically go away. But unfortunately, they're still there and have my name on them. So, you know, with that being said, it is and has been a priority for me to raise my son, who is a senior graduating this year. To just ensure that he knows he's not accruing any debt during his university. So, you know, fortunately, there are a lot of great online programs. So he'll be going online for 2 years, and it's a cheaper arrangement. So he'll still be earning his bachelor's degree over the 4-year course, but we're working it out to where he pays some, I pay some, grandparents are paying some. And I've just raised him in a way just that he understands how serious student loans are. And the interest just accrues so quickly that you just, it's hard to get on your feet after graduation. So that is how I've raised him. And I think it's a priority to teach our, you know, children that you don't have to take loans, that there are other ways and you can work little by little at, you know, university as well as working yourself and just finding other alternatives.
It's going to be really interesting to see how that university industry unfolds during the pandemic and beyond as well. We will, of course, be keeping you informed on all the latest developments.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Speaking now to Hind Shafani, an Oscar-nominated screenwriter and filmmaker, and the short she co-wrote and edited is called The Present. It's on Netflix now. She knew she wanted to pursue filmmaking when she was a teenager. Years later, studied at NYU and began pursuing documentary filmmaking. She was busy but took the time to chat to me on Zoom. And I asked how it's been releasing work, pitching ideas and trying to get noticed during these strange times.
I actually have just finished shooting a 3-year project in the Galilee in Palestine. This is my next feature film, is a project about the Christian minorities of the Galilee in sort of historic 48, up in the north of the country at the border of Lebanon. I come from a small village there, and I haven't yet seen an exhaustive ethnographic, contemplative, identity-driven film about the beauty and the identity complexes and the nuance and the landscape of the indigenous Palestinian Christians who come from that place, you know, where Jesus is from Nazareth, Haifa, Fasuta, Tarshiha, Mealia, where I'm from. And so I've been filming for 3 years this idea of return to my homeland, which I was able to do a few years back at the age of 38, you know, after living a long life in the diaspora, I was able to go home. And so I filmed all of that, and I was supposed to be editing last year. And then when the pandemic hit, I had to postpone all of my client work, which I had 3 massive projects. And so I was very grateful on some level, and I know this is kind of crappy to say, but I was grateful that I did not release my film last year, because I thrive on, you know, personal interactions. I want to hug my audiences. I want to talk to them in panels. I traveled the world with Triple Long Exodus, and I want to travel the world again with They Planted Strange Trees, which is my next documentary about the Galilee. I want to be able to show it in various countries. I want to talk to people. I want to be there. And so I'm very relieved on some level that I waited, and that hopefully I will finish the editing this year. And then hopefully in 2022, I'll be able to, you know, thank you. And I'll be able to tour with the film. Having said that, I have so many dear friends who are in the film industry, amazing people who have worked so hard for so long on projects that took 7-8 years, you know, some of them, to make fiction features. Another reason I don't work on fiction so much, it can take up to 7 years to make a fiction. And it just, I don't know, for me, it sounds really intense and heartbreaking. But they do it, these amazing, persevering, incredible filmmakers. Farah Nabulsi, who directed The Present, also had to wait a long time to release. We began working on her short 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago. And so she's just now being able to celebrate it, and it got to the BAFTAs and to the Oscar. And I know from her journey that, you know, it's frustrating. You know, she's won so many awards. The film has won so many awards. It's gone to at least 40 international film festivals. And I would say that probably 95% of that was always virtual mm-hmm. for her, you know? And so I can imagine it's incredibly frustrating. And it's opened up another conversation, I think, internationally, in the sense that these very big streaming giants like Disney, like Netflix, like Apple, like Amazon, are potentially also now in a war somewhat with traditional cinemas like AMC and other very big chains. And we don't know when the pandemic ends if people are going to want to go to the cinema as often as they used to with the expense and the effort that that incurs, or if people are going to continue to pay $20 a month and have access to the latest and the brightest and the biggest.
It's so hard. I think it's such a personal thing, because some people go to the cinema for that sense of escapism of seeing something on the big screen. But it becomes a chicken and egg. You know, I love going to see films, but if there's nothing to see, then I'm not going to go. So, you know, it's a very tricky kind of line to tightrope along right now. And, yeah. You know, I'm sure as a filmmaker, you presumably want people to see it in the medium that you'd envisaged when you were making it, for it to be that immersive experience on a big screen in silence, not someone sitting next to you on your phone or pausing it to go and, you know, grab a snack or whatever. You know, you need people to be present, I guess.
Yeah. The idea that somebody would watch my feature film on a phone is utterly and incredibly, you know, astoundingly, like, vile as a thought. I mean, a laptop, I can understand, hopefully a TV screen, fine, no problem. But I always ask people never to watch anything I do, even my short films, even my, you know, showreel. I try not to ask people not to see it on their phones. I think that's, you know, maybe if you're on a, you know, train or something, okay. But like in general, hopefully people are able to watch things on bigger screens for that immersive experience. We spend so much time framing things, lighting things, color correcting things, fixing sound design. And then you watch them on this palm sized thing where you can't see anything. So, but I think that there will be a very big debate about that. It's already in the Oscars and Cannes. It's already issues with Martin Scorsese and Netflix and, you know, where to kind of premiere your film. I know Cary Fukunaga, who is my NYU classmate, you know, had to postpone the release of Bond, James Bond, because of the pandemic last year. So many
several times.
A lot of people have had to do a lot of difficult things because of the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. Having said that, considering what happened to so many families in the pandemic, this is a drop in the bucket. I mean, this is really not, it is the livelihood of many people, but, you know, in terms of some of the more human and awful experiences people have had on a personal tragic note, I mean, I can't say that filmmaking is really high on the list of things I think about in terms of the pandemic. But there will be an extremely interesting debate happening as to indie productions, big blockbuster films that are, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in budget will always make it to a big screen. People will always flock to see, hopefully not Wonder Woman, no, but, you know, something similar to that, or Superman or something. But people, you know, coming to see an independent Palestinian documentary or an independent, I don't know, Lebanese film or an independent, any, you know, so-called, you know, non-traditional or non-mainstream film, they will struggle to get into the cinemas because of financial issues. And we will see how that works out, I think.
Join the conversation on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Only on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Speaking now to Hind Shafani, a Dubai-based Palestinian filmmaker and writer. Her short, The Present, has been nominated for an Oscar. And I asked her how she found out about that nomination.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
I found out we were shortlisted a while back, and I'm the writer and the editor of the project. And I've been accompanying the director for the whole process of making the film. I'm very proud. I introduced her to her producer, my producer, Osama, on my project, and her main actor, Saleh Bakri. So it's like a little small family. All of us know one another. She entered into this community with this lovely idea, this lovely story that she wanted to have written. I wrote it with her, and we finished it. And then it's gone into this amazing journey, you know, that none of us could have expected, which is fantastic. really heartening, a massive silver lining to the past year. We were shortlisted. I couldn't believe it. And then, you know, I was like, right, okay, we're shortlisted. It's 10 films. Almodovar is there, you know, my favorite filmmaker, la, la, la. It's gonna, all going to be good. And then one day last week, I was literally trying to take a 10-minute nap because my life is incredibly stressful. And I got messages from several friends, Mabruk, Mabruk, Mabruk. And I just knew, we had been nominated. It's very overwhelming. I didn't know whether to laugh or cry. I didn't know what to do with myself. reached out to the team. You know, we all high-fived each other virtually again, which is kind of tough. And then we found out only 3 days ago that there is a ceremony, a very, very small ceremony with very, very minimal attendance. And we're not yet sure who's actually going to be going to the ceremony. So that's on hold. I know that the producer and the director will definitely be heading there, which is amazing. Amazing for Palestinian cinema, amazing for my friends, amazing for the film, amazing for the legacy of the stuff we did. And we're not yet clear who else can join them. So we will see. It's a month from now, a bit more than a month, and I will keep everyone tuned.
Oh, it's such an amazing accomplishment, especially in the face of the last year. I mean, and more important than ever, I think, as you say. And people can watch The Present on Netflix. So if people wanted to watch it now and catch up on the Oscar noms, when you say short film, how many minutes? And can you give us a quick plot synopsis? And
yeah, it's 22 minutes. The Present is a beautiful story. It's a simple story. It's a family story. It's a story of resilience. It's a great story about a man trying to do something as simple as buying a gift for his wife's anniversary. He and his wife's anniversary, and he sets out with his young kid, this beautiful young girl, whom I named Nesmin after my mother. And he sets out with her, and they're going to pick something up for his wife and return. And it turns into this odyssey, and it's a series of obstacles. And it ends on a very powerful statement, I think, about the power of the child, the power of this little girl, the power of, you know, familial bonds, and the power of the human spirit to break through. And I think that's what's captured the imagination of, you know, probably, I don't even know if tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands at this point. Once the things are on Netflix, you can't tell how many people are seeing them. But I can say that since the film has been on Netflix, which is one of the best things that Osama and Farah did, is put it on Netflix the last couple of days, it has now reached so many homes and so many people all over the world. Something the pandemic had, you know, really curtailed. A lot of film festivals geo-block. So only the country that you're in of the festival are you allowed to see the films. And now it's an international phenomenon. And the Oscar nomination, of course, makes very visible. So we're all extremely proud to have taken Saleh Bakri, to have taken Maryam Kanj, to have taken the story of strength and determination and solidarity with our Palestinian people to an international arena. I think that's an astounding achievement for the team.
Hinshu Farni there, all the best on that Oscar nom for the film she co-wrote and edited The Present, which you can watch on Netflix.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Thanks again for downloading the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. You can hear us live on Dubai Eye Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. And please don't forget to rate and subscribe. It helps other people find us, boost us in the ratings, and it means you'll get the podcast direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.